Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, August 8th, 2014. American airplanes are flying, humanitarian aid and bombing strikes in Iraq. Not a lot of peace, not a lot of love, very little understanding prevalent in the world today, particularly in the hotbed of activity in the Middle East. And as you probably know, it's all over the media, President Obama on Thursday was weighing whether to conduct humanitarian airlifts to a group of trapped non-Muslims in northern Iraq or to bomb the Islamic State, this Sunni militant group that has taken over a big swath of northern Iraq and parts of Syria. The president decided to do both. And first, to the easy part, I really don't have a problem with airlifting humanitarian aid to this group of individuals who have been rapidly displaced by the expansion of the Sunni forces in northern Iraq. I would prefer to see it done by somebody else. How about Saudi Arabia? They're big supporters of IS. They have the closest connections to this group. Not full allies. I don't want to oversimplify it. Where is the Red Crescent, the International Red Cross? Is there no one else who can airlift food and water to these individuals? Well, nobody else stepped up, and Obama, with a kind of flourish, announced that today America is coming to help. But also, America is coming to unleash more carnage from the skies. Because today, the United States sent two fighter jets over Erbil, and they tell us that they struck some gunnery sites controlled by IS. There were other strikes as well, and it's not clear if they came from the Iraqi government, the United States, and some Kurdish officials suggest that France may have aircraft in the area. I don't know about that, and that complicates factors because of, you know, air traffic control, and of course the biggest risk is that IS could shoot down one of these aircraft. And that would become a cause for war. You can hear John McCain ready to turn red-faced and demand that despite all of the reasons, all of the rational reasons for the U.S. to show restraint, that it would be time to attack and draw more blood. And I'm very concerned because in the American media, I was watching CNN for a while this morning, and finally they have moved away from their wall-to-wall coverage of the missing Malaysian airliner. But CNN is doing some interesting and potentially insidious things. I saw a live report from a correspondent in Erbil, and he highlighted a 40-year-old baby, a 40-day-old baby, and talked about the precarious future that this child faces. My first reaction was, oh my God, what propaganda. Here comes this emotional cause for America to conduct military actions in a part of the world where we have boxed ourselves in and really screwed things up very badly. We're really the last credible force who can intervene, especially when you take into account long-term considerations. And I also thought back to just a couple of years ago when Obama's humanitarian hawks, led by Samantha Power, said that we must immediately take military action against Libya because Gaddafi's about to slaughter 10,000 people in Benghazi. I think it was a huge mistake to take out Gaddafi. And I think that the U.S. is taking huge risks here. And I don't underestimate the lethal nature of the threat posed by the Islamic State. But we are so compromised, we are so conflicted, and a lot of it stems from our tight alliance with Israel. And so this is a very problematic situation. And I think many Americans feel that, well, it's only airstrikes. You know, as long as we don't put troops on the ground, it's not really a war. But the very reason that Obama cites for launching the military strikes in northern Iraq is that we have American military advisors there. He put them there. And now he says that we're taking military action to protect about 100 Americans who are in Erbil. He also referenced that we will protect Baghdad because there are Americans there. I'm also puzzled by how as many as 40,000 people wound up fleeing to this Mount Sinjar. You see a picture of it. It's a barren edifice. And it's a cul-de-sac. So they've gone up the mountain. They're surrounded by these Sunni armed militants, heavily armed with American munitions that they took from the Iraqi forces that melted in front of them. And, you know, I can't explain that, but that's the situation. And so, as I said, to airlift supplies to them, I don't have a big problem, but where's the Maliki government? Why isn't Baghdad taking care of that? Why do the Americans have to put ourselves at risk and take chances on a wider war, a regional war that could become a world war? I really think caution is important here. And I do believe that Obama has tried to resist these calls for action. But now, like the, you remember the phony story of Kuwaiti babies being thrown out of incubators by Iraqi forces back in Desert Storm? It was completely false. But it had a life of its own in the American media, and that's what I thought of when I saw the CNN report this morning, focused on a 40-day-year-old baby. And the question does arise. The president made clear that he notified Congress, trying to avoid the kind of conflict that he saw over the swap for American prisoner Bo Bergdahl. But Paul Findlay, who served as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives for 22 years, a key author of the War Powers Resolution, and one of the people who took on the veto by President Nixon to pass the law, quoted as saying, just as with threats to attack Syria last year, an attack on Iraq today violates the Constitution and the War Powers Resolution. As with any president, Obama commits an impeachable offense if he doesn't follow the Constitution. Some observers misread a section of the War Powers Resolution as giving the president 60 days to make war without a declaration from Congress. The section cited actually limits even war making in the event of an attack upon the United States, its territories, or armed forces, which is not the case in Iraq. In my view, says Congressman Findlay, retired, a tight rein on presidential war making is more important today than ever. The New York Times echoes the president's decision, says that the catastrophe there requires action. And again, unilateral American action seen as Christians taking on these Islamic extremists, deeply fundamentalist. That's a perception that is really hard to shake. One of the other calls is to provide new arms shipments to the Kurds. And that kind of makes sense because the Kurds have been confronting IS and trying to prevent them from overrunning the Kurdish region of northern Iraq. But that further complicates issues with Turkey. And today I had a wide-ranging conversation about the situation in Iraq, also the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, with Professor Mohammed Ayoub. He is an emeritus professor at Michigan State University, and he's published a new book called Will the Middle East Implode? One of the things I asked Professor Ayoub about is a report that I saw on CNN last night. The correspondent, Jim Sciutto, reported that there are 100 Americans who are in the ranks of the Islamic State, or ISIS, ISIL, whatever you'd like to call it. And I don't know that that's true, but that's what was reported. And then, going into deep speculation, this guy Sciutto said that his sources, presumably in the intelligence and military communities, say that this comprises a threat to our, and I choke on the term, homeland. Now, there is no indication that we have seen that al-Baghdadi, the leader of this relatively recently developed group, has any intention to export jihad or terrorism beyond the caliphate that he's attempting to set up by erasing the border between Syria and Iraq. And I consider this to be the kind of fear-mongering that was a hallmark of the Bush administration and a way of trying to, in some ways subliminally, get the American people to support this latest military action. Here's an excerpt from my interview that's released to subscribers today with Professor Mohammed Ayoub, in which he responds to my question about the speculation on CNN that ISIS or IS fighters might bring their jihad to the United States.
No, I haven't seen any evidence. I've seen similar reports, but those are, you know, there's no corroborating evidence. Mm-hmm. And like Al-Qaeda Central, I don't think the Islamic State is really focused on exporting its terrorism or its activities, if you want to use a neutral term, to Europe or the United States. I think they're much more focused on creating a state, an Islamic state or a caliphate, as they call it, within the Arab East, and first obliterating these boundaries. So they are more focused on what one would call the near enemy, whereas Al-Qaeda Central in the 90s and in the 2000s was much more focused on the far enemy, which was the United States. So I think that's another fundamental difference between the two.
You can hear my full conversation with Professor Ayoub. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And I don't know if you're aware of the right-wing news site World Net Daily. I call it World Nut Daily. And I, you know, rarely visit the site. I don't consider it terribly credible. But I was struck by a story that somebody linked me to there today, because World Net Daily is reporting that Syrian rebels who have joined the Islamic State of Iraq, or ISIS, IS, were trained in 2012 by U.S. instructors at a secret base in Jordan. Now, they're reporting this as news, and they're also patting themselves on the back, claiming that back in February of 2012, World Net Daily was the first to report that the U.S., Turkey, and Jordan were running a training base for the Syrian rebels in the Jordanian town of Safawi, in the country's northern desert region. Well, let's be fair, it was Sibel Edmonds over at BoilingFrogsPost.com who first reported the secret training base in Jordan and the involvement of the United States. And this blowback that is being suggested here by World Net Daily is, I think, a worthwhile story. And I think immediately of Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, the Democrat, who has repeatedly said that we should arm what he called the vetted moderate groups opposing the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And it's those moderate groups that we armed, some of whom are now fighting against the Maliki government and, in turn, the United States in the renewed civil war in Iraq. Now to the other flashpoint in the region, and there are many, but the one that's being followed most closely in the United States, of course, is the ongoing conflict between Israel and its attack on Gaza and the Hamas group. And this morning, Israeli time, when the 72-hour ceasefire expired, we saw the renewed hostilities. There are reports by Israelis that as many as 30 rockets have been fired from Gaza. And in response, Israel has sent air raids, and at least 5 Palestinians, including a 10-year-old boy, have already been killed. And the Egyptian foreign ministry, and by the way, Egypt is not an honest broker for peace here, but the Egyptian foreign ministry said in a statement that negotiations so far had yielded agreement on the great majority of topics of interest to the Palestinians. Now, we know the Palestinians have fairly focused demands. They want the blockade of Gaza lifted, and they want some prisoners released. And if there was agreement on that, then why did Israel walk away? Well, I don't know. And Hamas, unfortunately, is really digging in, and they appear to be uncompromising. I certainly support their aspiration to have the blockade lifted. But we know the tit for tat, or it's 3 tits for 1 tat, sorry about that, that Israel operates under. From Press TV, we learn that Israel has locked up more than 1,000 of its citizens who are Palestinian or Arab and who have participated in protests against the war on Hamas. We understand that the number is over 1,000 and that dozens of people are being picked up every week in the northern Israeli town of Nazareth. These are Arab citizens of Israel, almost all of whom are either Muslim or Christian. The Israeli forces have also arrested a large number of demonstrators across the occupied West Bank in recent days. And these are thousands of Palestinians reportedly being held in Israeli prisons. They have a policy called administrative detention, which is imprisonment without charge or trial, and it can be extended at the whim of the Israeli government. A week ago, as you may recall, there was a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas that didn't hold. And the issue was that Israel had redeployed some troops, they said, to expose tunnels along the Rafah border with Egypt at the southern end of the Gaza Strip. And today, the New York Times, with a byline from Isabel Kirshner, replays that episode and makes it, in my view, they've removed the doubt and nuance, and they tell the story from the Israeli point of view. But that's not the point I want you to focus on here. Kirshner also reveals what is called the Hannibal procedure. And if you remember, this skirmish near Rafah last Friday initially was thought to have led to the capture of an Israeli soldier. And as you know, Israel is very, very determined not to allow its soldiers to be taken captive. It calls that kidnapping, even though when they take thousands of Palestinians and lock them up, they don't use that term. So the Hannibal procedure was invoked. And this is really, really grisly. The policy on the state of Israel's part is that essentially, even if they put the captured individual, the captured soldier, at risk, that the preferred outcome is a dead soldier as opposed to a captured one. And the language here used by Isabel Kirshner in the Times is a little sanitized. Its most ominous clause, she writes, states that the mission is to prevent the captors from getting away with their captives, even at the risk of harming or endangering the lives of the captured Israeli soldiers. Endangering the lives, what they mean is killing them. And they go on to say in this article, in last Friday's episode, it appears unlikely that the Hannibal procedure caused the fatal injury of the missing soldier, 2nd Lieutenant Hadar Golden, who was later declared killed in action. Well, they're playing down speculation that the Hannibal procedure was used there. But if we're open-minded and skeptical, we have to consider the possibility that it was used, and that Israel allowed or actually killed its own soldier rather than permitting him to be captured. That's pretty dark, if you ask me. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my podcast with your subscriptions. People like Peter Carroll, Susan Gavet, she tells me she listens while she fixes dinner, Jeffrey Zeiser, and Gary Washington. They're all monthly subscribers, and I invite you to join them because I need your support to keep it all going, pay the bills here. All you have to do is go to peterbcollins.com under my picture on the homepage. A link says sign up. You click on that. Next page gives you options, $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And I appreciate all your support. I hope that you'll take the opportunity, if you're solvent and have the extra cash, to support the work I do here. John Kerry, desperate to notch a win, snuck into Afghanistan and announced today that he's brokered a deal between the rival candidates in the disputed presidential election. And he's essentially come up with a deal where the two candidates, Abdullah Abdullah and the former World Bank technocrat Ashraf Ghani, have agreed to abide by the outcome of an audit of the election, which both sides agreed was not a clean election, and that whoever wins is going to name the other one a chief executive officer with undefined duties. All right, Kerry, I know you need something to claim that you've been effective as Secretary of State. We'll see how that one works out. And in Egypt, I have frequently criticized the military dictatorship that has taken hold there for the spate of death sentences that have been handed down by courts in Egypt, mainly aimed at wiping out the Muslim Brotherhood. Some of these trials have seen death sentences pronounced for hundreds of defendants in less than 20 minutes. And yesterday, in a rare official rebuke, Egypt's highest Muslim religious authority, the Grand Mufti, refused to approve death sentences imposed by a court on senior leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. Some of this might be chalked up just to their religious affinities. But I think this is very interesting. Apparently, the Grand Mufti is allowed to object to these, but it's not necessarily binding. And a panel of judges said that they would send the sentences back to the Grand Mufti for him to reconsider. So I'm not sure if it will make any difference. And finally today, I want to comment on three races for the United States Senate that are currently underway. In Montana, John Walsh, who was appointed earlier this year to complete the term of Max Baucus, has dropped out of the re-election, or actually for him it was just election, the November election, after it was revealed that he plagiarized key portions of his master's degree thesis at the War College in Pennsylvania, the Army War College. So John Walsh says he'll complete the term through the rest of this year, but he's not going to run for a 6-year term to the seat. And The early speculation is the Democrats there have, I guess, a few days until August 16th to, I'm sorry, August 21st to replace him on the statewide ballot. And one of the people who's being mentioned is Nancy Keenan, a former head of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Now, I've talked to Nancy Keenan once. I think she's bright. She's good, certainly, on the issues of reproductive rights. And I have no idea what her foreign policy positions are or, you know, what kind of a senator she would be. But there is such a crying need for a pro-abortion, pro-contraception firebrand in the United States Senate that I have to say I am sympathetic to her as a replacement for John Walsh. Other possibilities include State Senator David Wanzenried and former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger, both who ran in the primary and lost to Walsh in the earlier primary this year. So we'll see how it plays out. If you live in the Big Sky State and you want to help me understand this any better, tell me your own thoughts about who should replace John Walsh. Send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. Now, in Alaska, the barely Democratic Senator Mark Begich, who, to be fair, is the first Democrat to serve in the Senate from Alaska since, 1974? That would have been Mike Gravel. Wow, Mike Gravel was the last Democratic senator from Alaska? Well, I do understand that you can't be a flaming liberal Democrat and get elected in Alaska. But it's a bit much when Mark Begich runs a TV ad, which features an airplane pilot, it says, who identifies himself as a lifelong Republican. And he endorses Begich because of his ability to work with his Republican counterpart senator, Lisa Murkowski, of the Murkowski clan and dynasty in Alaska. And so here we have Begich bragging to voters that, you know, he votes with Republicans something like 80% of the time. And this has pissed off Murkowski, who says that Begich has shown an alarming lack of regard for the truth, and he seeks to mislead and deceive Alaskan voters. But this is playing out in race after race. Take Kentucky, for example. Democrats are chomping at the bit, frothing at the mouth. What's your favorite corny phrase? They'd love to see Alison Lundgren Grimes defeat Mitch McConnell. Now, I'd love to see Mitch McConnell go away. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. But Alison Grimes is running on a campaign saying that she wants to be the senator from coal country. Well, I grew up in Cincinnati. I worked with a lot of guys from deep in coal country in Harlan County, Kentucky. And there's nothing to celebrate about coal. It isn't clean the way they say. Miners get killed when they go into the underground mines. The mountaintop removal approach is safer for miners, but it just devastates the landscape, the ecology, the environment. And, of course, Alison Grimes appears to be oblivious to the issues of climate change. Now, I know you got to do what it takes to get elected, whether it's in Montana, Alaska, or the Commonwealth of Kentucky. But if these people win, what have the Democrats gained? Much of the time, these people will vote against any progressive legislation, against the interests of the Democratic Party and its leadership. And this is kind of what happened to Nancy Pelosi. She won the speakership, but Rahm Emanuel had recruited all these corporate Democrats. And when push came to shove, they didn't support Pelosi's policy initiatives. And so, again, I have to say, what good is it to defeat bad Republicans only to replace them with Democrats who are just slightly better? Those are the ugly choices that we face in the midterm elections this year. Hey, thanks for joining me for news and comment today. This is the free podcast that you're authorized to share with absolutely everybody. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.